You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Nyjah Okoro. Nyjah is a phenomenal actress from New York, currently based in Los Angeles, where she's been doing work on stage and screen. She was in a class ahead of me at Juilliard back in the day, and her energy on and off stage always lights up the room. I admire her work so much, and I wish I got to see more of it in person. She did a national tour of August Wilson's Jitney last year, right up until the pandemic put everything on pause. So maybe some of you got to see her. We had a little bit of trouble with the recording quality on this episode, so I apologize in advance for a bit of feedback you'll hear now and again. I hope you enjoy the 165th episode of The Compass. In that is, when I say the dark side, what does that mean for you most often when I say that?
That's a good question. Let's start with the dark side, I guess, because the dark side to me is when you give up hope, when you don't have any expectation for joy in your life. You know what I mean? Like, you're not looking forward to anything, or everything feels monotonous to me. Like, for me, if I'm not excited about things or what I do, sorry, there's siren. What I do, then that's kind of the dark side for me, you know, not wanting to get out of bed, or, you know. And what do I do? So I am a big believer in having rituals in place. And so I sort of catch it before it comes, if that makes any sense. Like, I get ahead of myself. So I always start the day off with meditation. Lately, because I have more time, I've been consistently doing 30 minutes instead of my usual 20 minutes, or sometimes it used to be 15 minutes. I also visualize. So after my meditation, I'll like do a visualization session, or I journal every day. It's kind of my obsession. I love to journal. And it's like, sometimes I don't even know what I'm feeling until I start journaling.
Is that something that's been a part of your life for a long time?
It has. There was a time when I had found out that an ex had gone through my journal. And also growing up, my mama used to go through my journals. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm just telling the truth. So I remember going through phases of not journaling, just phases. Or when I would journal, I would censor myself. So I went through years and years of kind of keeping up with it, but censor, you know, it's sort of like that, just in case somebody found this, you know, and went through it, you know. So, but what I've discovered is I'm doing myself a disservice by doing that. So yeah, for the last, you know, three or four years, I've been just journaling without fear of someone finding it, because I realized that doesn't serve me. I mean, it kind of defeats the purpose of journaling your emotions and thoughts. And so I take a huge pleasure in it, and I kind of make it into a ritual. You know, I like light candles and burn incense, and, you know, I have my favorite pen. There's like a brand of pens I use. And so because I start the day that way, and sometimes I'll do some reading, I also figured out that, you know, we can say we're busy, but if you read a chapter of a book a day, which doesn't usually take as long as we think, it's like all of a sudden you're like, I just read a book in like a week and a half, you know, because a chapter can turn into two. So anyway, when you start the day like that, I feel like even when things happen, I'm already on the upside, you know, like I've already thought about what I'm grateful for. I've already, you know, tapped into my true feelings. I already feel grounded. So I can kind of handle the ins and outs of the day better.
That's so smart. That even on the days when you don't feel like starting the ritual.
Yeah.
Like, it's so ingrained that you just can't.
Canvas. Oh no, yeah. I actually look forward to it. That actually is like, but see, I also realized that because I'm a big believer in making things into a ritual, whatever that means for the person. So if it means, like for me, I'm a coffee hat, I'm addict, you know? So it's like, I know I'm going to have some good coffee. I'm going to have and I love candles. So I'm like, I'm going to light my favorite candle, you know, I'm going to burn some, like, you know, some Palo Santo or some incense, uh-huh. or whatever. And my place is set up, you know, like the couch and everything just looks good to me. I might have fresh flowers. Like it's all about what brings me joy. And so it's actually a joyful experience. Sometimes I actually, like, it's funny because of COVID right now or quarantining, I find myself letting these rituals go on for like 3 hours. I'm like, Naja,
the whole day.
Naja, get yourself together and do something else. Cause I'm enjoying it. I'm like, when quarantine is over, I don't know what I'm gonna do with myself. I'm gonna be like, I don't have 5 hours to journal, meditate, visualize, do my yoga. Like, oh, what am I gonna do? Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
There's a part of me, like Frankie and I have been having an equally beautiful and hard experience, but different as mm-hmm. parents. And I wish that I had a little more time to invest in self-care things. But I recently started going through the Artist Way again.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And basically the only thing I've accomplished so far is that I've been holding myself to doing those morning pages.
Okay.
Exercise, which is just like free writing.
Yeah.
Every morning.
I've never done the Artist Way. Uh-huh.
I've never completed it. I'm trying it again.
Yeah. But
just taking the time to even do those, I'll do like these 3 pages, mm-hmm. like while Sassy's already awake in her crib and I just haven't gone in to get her yet. But something about at least like claiming the time to write those 3 pages for myself has been really, really
helpful. I can't even imagine how like – because I mean, I can't lie, as I'm telling you all these things I do, I felt almost self-indulgent because I'm looking at a mama.
I'm living through
you. You know what I'm saying?
I'm living through you. Do it for both of us.
Oh, good. Okay, good.
How are you doing at this point in all of this pandemic?
I am ultimately good. I've learned a lot about myself. I've sort of had a lot of, I spent about 4 months in New York, in the Bronx, because I had a show that was supposed to be done out there. So I went there and just being, in my childhood home, I had some like trauma stuff that came up for me, pretty strongly. Mm-hmm. Apparently when you do yoga, it unlocks traumas in your body. Found this out. My therapist actually said that. She was like, oh, it makes sense that you would, you know, because I had to seek therapy. I was like, this is a lot happening. Like memories were coming up that I had not addressed. So apparently, because Nigel always gives us something to do that's challenging, I had challenged myself to 30 days of yoga straight. Cause like I have a love hate relationship with yoga. Like I love the way I feel. I don't always love doing it. I don't want to do it. I'm like, what is this? What is this? What is this? But I always know I feel better. You know what I mean? So I was like, nope, you're going to do yoga straight, an hour a day for 30 days. And all of a sudden, all this stuff just started coming up. It was incredible in exactly the way incredible the word is. It's like it was just massive and ridiculous and painful. And so I'm actually grateful for that because it's like I addressed things that I had never faced. Clearly I wasn't ready to. So it was hard. But I feel stronger than I have ever. It's funny because people used to always say to me, Naj, you're so strong. And I'm like, no, there's a lot going on in here. Like, I just have to be strong. You know what I mean? Like, so what you uh-huh. see is a construction. Like, if I don't know how to move through this world and have a shell, I would not have survived. I literally would not have been here. You know what I mean? That doesn't mean that the shell is actually part of my natural makeup. You know what I mean? That's
right. A construction. That's what you had to do.
Right. So people would comment on the construction and I'm like, that's not, I'm a softie actually, you know, but it's, I couldn't be, you know, you grew up in the Bronx, you just can't be. So how am I doing in this COVID? So the quarantine's been awesome in some ways, because you know you get to you get to journal for hours if you want. you get to deal with childhood traumas you never addressed. You know, you
get to. I mean, like you said, in some ways, how amazing that you're now starting to deal with it, but how crazy to have it all surface when you're isolated in the middle of a worldwide event like this.
Yes. 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 And coming at you and it's, you know, it's childhood traumas in your childhood home. Like it's just a lot. It was nuts. It was like daily downloads, like daily memories. Like it was, I can't even explain to you what this was. And it went on for a while. And, I also experienced a lot of, I guess I'm really sensitive to energies, you know, and there is an air of pain and there's a lot going on with people right now. So part of what was very healing to me was walking. Like I would go for walks, you know, and I mean, you know, because I was trying to walk something off, meaning like stress and, you know, or traumas, I would walk for, I mean, easily 9 miles, 10 miles. I mean, just walk, 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 walk. Sometimes walk and cry. Sometimes walk and laugh. Sometimes walk and sing and talk.
That's the thing about New York.
Yes. But what I found was I think because there are less people in the street. I think because people are all of a sudden wearing masks. I think because people are distant now. I think people who have certain types of mental illnesses, I think it's exacerbating and like it's making their it's triggering people in ways that I can't explain because I'm not, you know, I don't know them, but I just, all I know is I've been followed, someone tried to grab me, another person masturbated and was staring right at me on the train at 59th Street by our school, like in the middle of the day, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, another guy followed me on the train. Another one followed me for blocks and blocks when I ran and somebody else called the cops. I mean, this is like, it was happening so much that I was like, what, it got to the point where I started becoming fearful, but then I'm going through this trauma stuff that I need to walk. And I'm telling myself, it's fine. You know? And then I got to LA and I thought, oh, I'm in the clear, you know, because it's just New York. Immediately crazy stuff started happening again with like, I got followed. Another man like just started screaming at me.
I mean, people are under every kind of pressure right now and you never know where that puts them.
Right.
And like, the weird anonymity of the mask and the social distancing.
I think so. Can you
feel like,
can you
you're
imagine
not gonna wanna confront them?
Yes. Yes. And can you imagine if you, cause I try to put myself in other people's shoes as much as I can, you know, I mean, that's what we do. Right. But like, I'm thinking to myself, if I had say some sort of a paranoia going on, right. And all of a sudden you look around, and people got masks on and they're moving away from you every time you maybe ask for money or something, or you know what I mean? Like, and that, can you imagine? I can't even imagine. So I'm a big part of me is compassionate. And sometimes people are just trying to talk, but they don't know what they're, you know, like doing. But it's a very interesting time. So it's like, I mean, I have since, you know, I got my mace, I got a stun gun, and I've decided, I mean, this is literally a new development where I'm like, no, I'm safe. I'm fine. I am fine. I will handle whatever comes. I mean, this is from a girl who's been in shootouts. You know what I mean? Like, I've literally been in shootouts, ducking bullets, like numerous times growing up. So for me to be this scared, like I started getting so scared when I got back to LA that for a full week, I didn't go outside. That's not me at all. My mind started going, oh no, I can't, it's not safe out there. And I just said, F that, F that. And I just, it's now I'm bouncing all over the place. Yeah.
I'm glad you're finding your way through it. It's just, so strange, and it's so strange that it's been going on this long. It's like, I don't, you know, your mind goes back and forth between focusing on the day-to-day things, and you're like, I'm fine, I'm just moving through it, I'm moving through it, and then just thinking about the larger state of the world, and then you're you know, don't open my eyes for a full day, and your head is like pounding, you know. It's bizarre.
Yeah, it is really bizarre.
So in the midst of all that, shifting gears or not shifting gears, because that's the reality of what we're in right now. How are you feeling as an artist? Because you just said that you shot a little film on Zoom.
So oh, yeah, that was
a few little projects going on, but.
Yeah, it seems like, yeah. I feel like I've actually been kind of busy, but I don't know if it's because I'm loving my 3 hours of self-care in the morning. So I'm like, you know, if I have things to do, I'm like, it's a lot to do. It feels like more than it used to feel, you know? And also when you're auditioning, you know, it's like, it's a self tape thing. And, you know, and I started doing this thing where I tape myself on a recorder and I just look at a dot, and I'm just, cause I don't want to keep, you know, calling people, for help. I ain't asking for help. So I just started just doing it my way.
Well, that's good that auditions are picking up again.
Yeah, they have been. And I've had some really fun ones. Well, fun meaning like stuff I can like dig into. And so it's been good. You know, it's been good. It's stressful dealing with the technology side of it for me. But I've decided that, you know, I heard somewhere you got to make your, you know, greatest weakness your greatest strength. So I'm like, well, yeah, that's the weakness. I suck at all things technology. So I'll figure out how to be better. So yeah, so as an artist, I mean, I've been feeling busy. Like there was a film that came out recently. So I was doing like a lot of interviews for that. I am doing a lot of interviews for that. And, you know, doing film festivals online, which is like, you know, first of all, it's kind of cool to be in film festivals and then like, you know, but to like be doing Q&A's. Yeah. Doing Q&A's online on Zoom. Funny enough, it was so hot in the Bronx when I was doing a lot of some of these Q&As. I was like in a full-on sports bra because my mama don't have AC in the house. And it was like, I mean, 100 degrees, and she got like the oven on for something. And I'm like in full sports bra. And I just learned how to just like crop it so it looks like a tank top. But I'm like, these people don't know I'm in my underwear and I'm still dabbing sweat. I have so many auditions in sports bras. I was like, these. And then when it comes to the slate, that's when I put on clothes. All of a sudden I put on like jeans so that it looked like I was always wearing it. And I like, you know, throw a shirt on. But I'm like, these people don't know. I'm literally in my underwear doing these auditions.
It's You're hot. Not the only one, I'm sure.
Oh, no. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of stories. But I actually feel like this is a great time for the arts. I feel like this is like, because I think, like, to have to process all of this, I mean, it's maddening, right? Like, I mean, we're all, like, going through. I mean, there's just so much happening. It's endless. And I feel like, how many times have you watched a movie or went to a play and just was changed or saw something in a different way, or like you could process something that you just couldn't fathom before? You know, maybe it could be seeing someone's point of view or or understanding an idea or seeing yourself differently. And I feel like now more than ever, we need that. Like, it's like, we just need the arts. We need songs. We need, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, just yesterday, I mean, I turned on some music and I was like, I just started getting my whole life walking, you know, because I've learned to just not be scared anymore. But part of that is like, no, I'm gonna put on some music. I'm gonna just raise my vibration and I'm not gonna be scared. And I was singing and walking and I probably, you know, looked crazy. That's probably why no one really bothered me. But yeah, so I just think it's the perfect time. The perfect time for artists to just keep going, somehow. Yeah. I don't know how, but we're needed.
I think you're right in that in one way it's bizarre because there's like a complete shutdown of theater. I'm so glad TV and film is kind of getting back on its feet.
Yeah.
So there's this weird incubation period where I feel like when we do come out on the other side, the stuff that's going to come out of artists is going to be really incredible and really cathartic.
Yeah. And I also think, I think like my experience with dealing with stuff that came up from the past and sitting, you know, cause you know, all these things, people, I feel like it's a collective thing. I feel like everyone has their own version of that. It might not be dealing with traumas, but it might just be, let me sit by myself and think about myself, or let me sit and think about my actions. Or you know what? I mean, like the fact that the earth is healing in a way right now, you know what I mean? People are seeing peacocks out and, you know, like the air has changed. I mean, the fires, that's different, but you know what I mean? Like it's, I feel like this is a time of everybody go to your corners and sit and think about what you're doing. Just think about it. You know? Think about it. And
in every way.
In every way. So I believe what you're saying. When things do open up, I think artists are going to have so much material. They're going to be deeper and richer and fuller. I mean, if you just sit with some of the stuff that comes up for you, you know, at a time like this, you're golden. You're golden.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
I really want to talk about the tour you did last year.
Yeah, yeah.
Of August Wilson's Jitney, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get to see it yet. I'm hoping that at some point in the future
you'll come back. Right?
But can you tell the listeners a little bit about what that tour was? It's just one, the idea that you're touring a straight play is incredible to me, because when does that happen? Like only musicals tour.
That's actually true. You know what? Why didn't I ever think about that? That's actually
maybe,
true.
Maybe a couple, like, or like, yeah, or but they'll go to LA and happen. That's it.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. It really doesn't happen. No, I never thought about that for some weird reason.
And especially having done that right before this shutdown, where now the idea of traveling across the country and telling a story to all these different rooms of people is just insane. What did you learn on that tour? What was the experience like?
Yeah.
And yeah, just tell them a little bit about it. I would love to hear.
Yeah. So yeah, so it was August Wilson's Jitney. And it takes place in a sort of a gypsy cab station, also known as a Jitney station, in Pittsburgh. In the 70s, and I was the only woman in the, you know, in the cast. That's, you know, that's Jitney. And it was funny, the play I did before that was Two Trains Running, and I played Risa, the only woman in the cast. So it was like a kind of cool, and actually I discovered, I think Risa and Rena are two sides of the same coin in terms of how they have processed life. It's very interesting. Like, I feel like Risa kind of went to the dark and Rena went, nope, I'm going to be all that I can be. And I'm going to be this, you know, so Rena, the character I played in Jitney, for people who don't know the play, she is the mother of a young son with young blood, who actually was played by Murari Cheatham, who we went to school with.
I know.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? It was a dream. Yeah, and Francois was in the play as well, who we also went to school with. Irina, the character, is a very, she speaks her mind, even when it's not necessarily, even when it's an unpopular idea, let's say. She's very forward thinking. She was in school for accounting, you know, in the 70s with a young kid in, you know, in Pittsburgh, you know, and in the play, I won't give the play away, but basically I learned a lot from Rena. She's young. She's young, but she still spoke her mind no matter what. Like that, even when I read the play years ago, I was like, oh, she said what? Like she just is unapologetic about her, you know, about making a relationship work, what it takes, what communication means, you know, because in the play, Youngblood does something that he thinks Rena would love. So he's hiding it from her. And when she finds out what it is, you know, any woman usually would like fall out and love it. But she goes, no, you did all this behind my, you didn't talk to me. You didn't, we're a team. Like what, you know, and in playing her for almost 7 months, it's like I got into the mindset of speaking my mind. So I started, and that's not like me. Like usually I'm very, you know, it's important for other people to be comfortable. You know, I like to make people happy. I'm like a, you know, a joyful person. And not that I still wasn't joyful. I was very joyful, but I found myself saying things that, you know, that were true to me, but I would have normally not said because I would have been too afraid of what someone, you know what I mean? How they might take it. So I've been practicing that in life. It's just kind of speaking up for myself instead of like letting people, you know, do things that are not. So that was cool. And getting to just work and do a story, be part of a story that I love, and to do that for six plus months. Because we got cut short because of COVID, it was a dream. I mean, to go to these wonderful cities with the amazing ensemble I got to be a part of. I mean, Anthony Chisholm is a legend, you know. I remember watching him on Broadway. And because a lot of the Broadway, this is the National Broadway Tour, so a lot of the Broadway cast was a part of this production.
Oh, I see.
So like Amari, Francois, and I were like a few of the people who replaced, but it was mostly the same cast. Or maybe like half and half, if I had to think of the numbers. But so it was just, and getting to work with Ruben Santiago Hudson, who I am up. Like if anybody has not seen Ruben on stage, get your whole life and go run and see him. It is a marvel. He's a marvel on stage. He's a marvel on screen too, of course. But what I loved about working with him is he always reminds us of the why, like why we do what we do. So it's like for him, it was like, y'all know what y'all doing, but why are we doing this? You know, it was sort of like he would come and talk about maybe a newspaper article he read about, and it'll be about some sort of like social issue, and, you know, and he'll get charged up and he'll charge us up, and, you know, or he'll be like, oh, today's the anniversary of the four little girls, you know, getting killed. Right. And, you know what I mean? Like, and it's
right. So you don't just get like too focused in on the importance of the rehearsal room and what we're doing with this prop.
No. He always reminded us of the why, and I will take that forever. And what was cool about what Ruben did, this is my first time on tour, so I didn't know that this was how it goes. This was not how it goes. This is not typical, but Ruben came to every city and rehearsed us. Like every city and rehearsed us and cracked the whip every time. We stayed in most cities. I would say we stayed about a month. We stayed in Detroit because it was Detroit Music Hall. So it was this huge, like it was like being in Madison Square Garden. So we only stayed there for a week, but everywhere else we stayed for at least a month. And he came to every city. He came to LA, to DC, to Detroit, to San Diego, to LA.
Did you get to do it in Pittsburgh?
No, that would have been amazing. Yeah, people have talked about that. Like, we should really get to do this in Pittsburgh. But August Wilson's niece and nephew came to see, they were super sweet. They came and did talkbacks and stuff, and they absolutely loved it. They've seen Jitney 1,001 times, and they loved our production. So, yeah, it was pretty incredible. So it was great, and just, you know, on a on a very, like on a personal level, it really meant a lot to me to, you know, because I didn't grow up with a father in my life. And so I was raised by a single mom. And there's something about being around Black men, stand-up men, seeing men who take care of their families, seeing men who take care of me. Like they were, I mean, you would have thought I was on a throne the way they treated me. They were the sweet, still the sweetest, still checking in, still, you know what I mean? Like they absolutely just, I miss them. And, but it did my soul just, it was almost like God is like, oh, I got you, girl. I got something for you to heal. Some balm. I got some balm for that little wound. So that was wonderful too, you know?
How amazing.
I miss them.
Was there, I mean, I don't want to idealize it in my mind too much, you know, that you're working on this play that, you know, his writing in my mind is like Shakespeare. He's just such an incredible writer.
Yes.
But you know, you're doing a show for 6 months. There must have been times where you were like dragging. Did you figure out any ways to get back on track?
You know what's interesting? I am usually like when I do a show, you know, about the 6 week mark and I know it's about to be over. I mean, I would never tell anybody this, but people are usually sad and crying and, you know, and I'm usually sad because I know I'll miss the whole experience. And I love, you know, I love doing plays, but usually right around that, I think that's why I love being an actor. I love things changing. You know, I love this, you know, like I used to like waiting tables. I was like the one person who loved waiting tables because there's always something new happening. I could change restaurants and learn a new menu if like, you know, if I got bored. And usually towards the end of a show, I'm like, okay, ready to move on. Loved it. Ready to like, I'm ready for the next thing. What's next? Oddly enough, it's funny when, I found out I had gotten this job, I thought my manager was like, child, you don't listen to nothing I say. Cause he was like, I told you it was a 7 month tour. I was like, you did not. And I was like, and how much does it pay? Oh my God. He said, I told you how much it pays. And I was like, you did not. And I was like, go to six cities or whatever, how many cities, five cities. And he was like, Naja, you're ridiculous. Cause I don't listen to anything. I'm just like, okay, audition or whatever. Or I got a job. Yay. What is the, you know, tell me the fine print now that I know. I could have sworn it was just like a 2 month gig or something like that. I had no idea. I think I would have been like, I can't do it. I can't, 7 months. Like, that's a long time. And so when I found out I got it and found out it was 7 months, I said, oh, geez, like, I don't know what's going to happen. And honestly, I could have kept going. Like, there's so much to mine in Wilson's work. There's so much to mine. And I think having different cities definitely ignites the sort of the, you know what I mean? Like if we were in the state, like if we stayed in DC or stayed in, you know, Seattle or something, maybe it might be different, but every city was a different audience. I mean, they were completely different, these audiences. I mean, in Detroit, as Ruben said, some people were playing cards in the back, passing around chicken. Like he's joking, I'm sure, but like he wasn't. Like there was an energy of, you know, we're chilling, you know, like this is not. And some audiences were like super quiet, but then would leap to their feet in tears, you know? So we were like, uh-oh, okay. So everyone loved it. That was across the board. Thank God. But like,
yeah, that of course makes it easier to do it for 7 months.
Yeah. Some cities spoiled us. I mean, absolutely spoiled us. Like we couldn't get words out without like uproarious laughter or like some cheering. Mm-hmm. Like I remember doing a monologue and getting like applause like three times in the same monologue. It made no sense. That never happened. Like it did not make sense that all of a sudden they would just erupt into applause. There was no, you know, as actors, we kind of know the moments that could possibly get something. So we're ready to like maybe pause for it. If something happened, Naja as Rena was like, will y'all stop? Cause I got something something to say. Like, I didn't know what was happening. I was like, why are they breaking out into applause? This is not, I got something to say. I was so bothered that day because I was like, I just want to keep going and y'all stop it. You know, because Wilson has a rhythm. He has a rhythm. And if you break that rhythm too much, it just, it's jarring. You know what I mean?
Right. But that just goes to show like how excited they were that you brought this piece of art to their city.
I think so. I think people were hungry for it. That's actually a great point. I think they were just hungry for this kind of work, this kind of artist. Like, I mean, Wilson is amazing. So yeah, no, I did not drag my feet. Oddly enough, it was amazing. Odd. It was odd. I would have put money on it. But, you know, I would have been like, ooh, Leah, I bet by the end of this thing, I'm gonna be like, you know, running. But no, I could have, I mean, it was so sad to end, actually. Yeah, it was sad to end.
So happy for you.
Thank you. It was a great experience.
I do want to talk about your film that just came out, but I wanted to ask first just about, because I know you went to undergrad before you went to Juilliard.
Yes.
I did too, but I studied acting in undergrad. And did you study psychology?
I did. I graduated with honors. Yes.
So I'm curious about what made you decide to go into acting after that.
So before I went to school for psychology, I went to LaGuardia, the High School of Performing Arts. So the quote unquote fame school, like the school Fame was based on. And it was a great school for the arts, but academically it was a regular New York City high school, public high school. So half of our day was dedicated to the arts, and then the other half was to academics. But we had, I mean, books that were old as ass, excuse me, I hope I could say ass, but books old as dirt. Like you could just feel, and no shade to the school now, hopefully things have shifted, but I'm talking about, I mean, I did not feel educated is what I'm saying. And I wound up cutting a lot. Like I barely went to school. Like I went to my acting classes, of course, you know, I went to my, you know, but I would just cut the rest of the day and I would actually cut and go to the performing arts library most of the time across the street and just like, you know, read books or play with my friends and like, just be silly and like go whatever. I cut so much and I would just show up for tests and I would, you know, invariably pass. I don't know how I just passed everything, but I was like, if y'all don't care, I can't really care about this. And so when I graduated, I felt like I always knew I wanted to act, but I just felt like I did not want to be an acting dummy. You know what I mean? Like I just needed to know more. I needed to grow and like learn to process information and to like think critically, you know, be challenged. And so my mother was the first person in my family to go to college, and she used to take me to school with her sometimes. I was in junior high school while she was in college, and so sometimes she would let me sit in her class, and she took psychology. So I would even answer the questions. You know what I mean? Like I would get involved in the class, and I just remember being fascinated by psychology. So I was like, well, like if I wasn't an actor, I know I probably would be a psychologist. Easy. So I just wanted to study and learn and do something else. And I actually did not audition for Juilliard wanting to go. It was an odd thing. So they almost never seemed to accept, like people never got in from my school. Like it seemed like, it felt like that. Yes, you know, you get some dancers here and there, but like, it just felt like with all this talent here,
from LaGuardia, you mean?
Right. Uh-huh. From LaGuardia. It was like the rare occurrence that a drama student got in to the drama department at Juilliard. So I just remember always thinking of Juilliard as this snooty, uppity place that doesn't take take any of us. You know what I mean? Like we're not good enough for Juilliard. And so in my mind, they all had their noses in the air and they were just these people who like, ugh, you know. So I auditioned thinking, oh, no way they're going to take me. I just wanted to get over the fear of feeling like I'm fearful of auditioning for this place, you know, because I didn't, you know, but as soon as I even auditioned, I was like, oh, I want to go here. Because it's, you, I mean, as you know, it's the most down to earth, place. Really? And I was like, I could easily go for drinks or coffee with any one of these teachers, you know, like, but it was the most, oh, it was an incredible experience. It was an incredible experience. I remember my mother when came with me, and she's so silly. So there's like a list they put up of the callback list, you know, for the rest of the day. And I think there was like three people on the list, you know, or maybe four people. And my mother, who's, you know, an older Black woman, you know, she walks up to Kathy Hood, our, you know, the Kathy Hood, who's our mother, basically, at Julia, and walks up to her with these fake tears going, I don't see my name. So Kathy is so sweet. She's like, I mean, this woman is, you know, like in her 60s, you know, and Kathy is so sweet. Kathy was like, okay. And my mother goes, I'm just playing with you, girl. She's so late. Yes. So it was just a beautiful place. So yeah, that's what got me to Juilliard was just, you know, wanting to be back into acting, because I was also involved in social work, and like I had 1,001 jobs in my life. And I knew I always wanted to get back to acting, but I just kind of wanted to live and just be smarter, you know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I went to a liberal arts school. And while I was really deep into the theater program, I really appreciated getting to study just kind of all of the random English and history classes and math and science and all of that. I needed that. I'm always so impressed with the people in our school who went there as undergrads, but I mean,
I don't know how they did it.
I don't know how they did it either.
I would not have made it. I really don't know how they did it. Like, to be 18 and go into Juilliard. Some 17. Seth was like 16.
Some of them moving to the city for the first time. Oh, and
my goodness.
So intense.
Oh my goodness. It's such an intense program. And it's also an intense exploration of yourself, you know, mm-hmm. like that. It would just be a lot for me at 18. Like, wow.
Yeah. I think about it all the time, honestly. Like, I don't know if I'm just curious in my head about mm-hmm. what I would learn if I went through it now, knowing what I know about myself.
Oh my God, Leah, I think the same thing. I always think the same thing.
And in my head, it's not that long ago, but it has.
It really does not feel like as long as it's been.
It's just such a pivotal part of my experience.
I think about it too. I think, oh my God, to be in Richard's class now. Were you there at the 50th? Reunion. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, wasn't that incredible? That was getting a taste of what it would be like now. You know what I mean? That was a beautiful taste. I mean, I had so much fun in Richard's class, and just, you know, it's funny because I did not understand Richard's class when I was in Richard's class. Like, I didn't get Richard I loved him and I wanted to get him, but I'm a student. I'm like a natural student. Tell me what to do. Like, you know what I mean? Like, give me the way.
This is our first year acting class.
Oh, yeah. Anybody who's listening. Ooh. Yeah, and it's very imaginative. Yeah, and it's very imaginative, and it's very like, okay, so you're on a magic carpet, and what does it feel like? And okay, and now you're flying. Oh, there's a bird. And it's just like, and I remember it's like 10 o'clock in the morning or something. I'm like, what is he talking about? Let's get to it, you know? And
Am I getting an A?
Right. And you don't even get grades at Juilliard. Like, I was like, God dang it. Like, what is this place? And I remember working with Richard as our director in our fourth year. And then I started to understand the imaginative work. And when I tell you, that is the stuff I go to now. Like, it is the most fun. And at the 50th reunion, which is where there was a celebration that Juilliard had for our 50th anniversary, where students of all years came back and took classes with the teachers there. And so it's like all age groups. And like, it was just, and I remember being in Richard's class When I say I got my whole life, Leah, like I got my whole life. He was talking about a carpet. I was like, yes. And I was just, I mean, I was giggling at things like, I mean, like flowers that weren't there were making me giggle. And underclass, I mean, the people that were at school at the time, they weren't allowed to take the classes. I think they were like facilitating or helping or whatever. And a few of them came up to me and was like, I couldn't stop watching you. And I was thinking to myself, that's what they mean when they say, if you're interested, you will be interesting. Cause I was fascinated with everything that was happening. I was like, that could have went on for hours. And I remember when I was in school, I was like, what is this? What is he talking about?
Okay. Changing gears. I mean, you're such a New Yorker. You grew up in New York.
Yes.
You went to school in New York.
Yes.
How has it been to live in LA? You've been in LA for a long time now, right?
Since 2008, right after graduation. Like I did a thing at Sundance with Amari, actually, funny enough, and then came right out here. Like, because it was sort of like, they were like, well, you can, I had signed with reps out here after our showcase. And it was sort of like, well, you can either go to LA. Like his rationale was like, look, you got to start your life somewhere. Like you're going to have to get a regular job somewhere. So you could maybe start in LA, you know? And then I was like, oh, that's a good idea. I could always work my way back to New York, you know? And yeah, it's been the first, man, at least the first 4 years were like rough. Looking back on it, I can say it was rough. I'm a happy, sunshiny person, so I always found joys and stuff. Like I did. I wasn't like sitting around depressed. It's just when I look back on it, I'm like, I just missed home. I missed New York. I missed the pace. I didn't even know how to drive when I came out here. I learned to drive because I told myself, if you move to LA, you have to learn how to drive. And immediately. And I never wanted to learn how to drive. I was the person who, like, if my ex-boyfriend or something would be driving and he'd be like, oh, don't you want me to teach you how to drive? I'm like, no, I'm good. Like, I loved being a passenger. All of it looked complicated to me. It was all too much. I'm a New Yorker. I like, give me a cab or a train or let me walk.
Well, driving in New York is too much. So I understand.
Driving in New York, right. So it's like, in my mind, I was like, driving is stressful. I don't want it. So when I moved out to LA, though, because I promised myself I have to learn immediately, I did. I took 2 driving lessons, got my license, and got a car. Knew nothing about buying a car. Didn't ask anyone about buying a car. Didn't say, hey, guys, like someone, friends, what car should I look for? Nyjah decides to do it all on her own, as she always does. I'm Googling what are the best cheap cars to buy. And I kept getting Hondas were the cheap, you know, the best cheap, like old cars to buy and most reliable. So I bought the first Honda I could afford. I did this all within a month and it only took that long. It took long to me because it only took that long because the DMV was on strike for some reason every time I kept showing up for my test. But so I'm driving. I drive to the gas station. I get out. I realize I don't know how to pump gas. I don't even know what to do. And I'm like, as a grown ass woman asking people, can you, I know this is crazy, but can you like, how do we do this thing called gas pumping?
It's like a movie about someone moving to LA.
It really is. And I didn't have a GPS. So I was writing in MapQuest instructions on the legal pads. I remember I used those to write out instructions. So if I got lost, I didn't know how to reroute myself. I was just lost. I was lost to so many auditions.
How
I remember
times have changed.
How times have changed. Yeah. Yeah. So no, it was definitely a journey getting out here. I remember the one day I said, oh my God, I think I'm actually starting to like LA. Like I, you know, I just had a great day. I was thrifting. I love to thrift. I went to thrift store today too. I love to thrift. So I was thrifting. I was like, you know, in LA, just kind of looking at the fashions, looking at the people. And I remember parking and I only remembered my parking spot. I never remember, but I remember because I was literally like smelling the roses. Like there was some beautiful roses right by where I parked. And I smelled the roses. And in dramatic Naja fashion, I look up to the sky and I was like, God, I think I like LA. And I went into this thrift store. I went in there for maybe an hour, talked to some people in there, had a good time, didn't buy anything, and came out, went to my car, gone. Stolen. Stolen. Oh, I was like, is this a sign? Is this a sign?
Oh, no.
I was like, this must be a sign.
And it was there.
It was a terrible car, too. Yeah, exactly. I'm still here. So it's been a transition. I mean, you know, for a long time, I definitely preferred New York. Now I'm at a place where I love New York. I can't say I prefer it anymore. I think this quarantine shifted things for me with all the stuff going on.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, New York is always home. I love New York, but I can be here too. You know, I can be here too. And there's so much to enjoy. Hiking trail and water and, you know, like it's just beautiful, actually.
I feel like the grass is always greener. So it's kind of actually nice that since you're from New York originally, like you can always go back.
Always.
Like you said.
Always.
Well, I know we've already been talking for a while, but I do want to hear about The Black Emperor of Broadway.
Oh, yeah.
I actually watched it last night.
You did?
I talked to you without watching it. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I especially enjoyed your performance.
Oh, thank you.
But it's so great that a movie got made about this story. I didn't know anything about it beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Leah, I didn't either. And, you know, as a Black woman in this Black story, that, you know, this is the first Black Broadway star, I was embarrassed. I was mortified that I had never heard of him. He was buried in an unmarked grave in the Bronx, and I never heard of him because he died penniless. They finally, I think it was the union, I want to say it was like Equity, that like got together and put money together some years ago and got him a great, like a marker. No, this is an incredible like story. I was embarrassed that I didn't know about his life. So yeah, you know, it takes place in the 20s and I played his wife and, you know, it was an indie film. I don't know how they did it. I mean, it was a shoestring budget. We shot it in Provincetown, Massachusetts, which was itself incredible. And that's actually an area where he spent a lot of his life, like working life. He worked out there.
And this is, I'm trying to get his name right. It's Charles Gilpin.
Mm-hmm. Gilpin. Charles Gilpin.
The actor that we're talking about, that this movie is about.
Yes. He starred in Emperor Jones, on Broadway, that Eugene O'Neill wrote, and they had a falling out because he would not use the N word. Like so they had a big falling out because it was all over the play. And it was a huge hit. It was like a massive success, this play. Like this play ran so long. Like it was a huge success. And then so he got fired, and then Paul Robeson took over, and then he wound up doing the movie. So then he became like a big star because of this role. But Charles Gilpin was the one who originated it. And yeah, so it was, you know, speaking of just what artists can do, like it's just important to like tell this story, and that was the exciting thing. It was like to be a part of telling this story that, you know, nobody knew about. Most people don't know about him, which is sad.
Yeah, and also just learning more about the history of that play too, I thought was really. I was really glad to learn more about it because I just remember in undergrad or you know, kind of going through all of O'Neill's plays and just kind of reading them on the page and not really understanding it or putting it in context. And so I thought I really enjoyed learning more about that.
Yeah. And it was revolutionary. It was revolutionary for O'Neill to actually want to put a Black man as the lead instead of like a white person with Black face. Like he decided, nope, actually it'll be sensational if we actually, you know, so it's a bit of publicity and like, you know, he knew it would actually cause a stir to actually put a real bona fide Black person, go figure, in a role of a Black person, you know,
yeah,
on stage. So He was also a businessman. It was a smart move. That part was a smart move, but it's sad how it all ended, you know?
How long were you guys actually shooting that film for?
Girl, I can't believe it. Like 3 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
No, it was like 2 takes. All right, got it. Let's go. Like it was that fast.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Good for them. Filmmaking is so, I mean, I guess it depends on the film, but there's just so much involved in making a film actually get to the finish line.
So much involved. I have to say, I've developed a love for indie filmmaking since then because of that experience. Because at first, you know, Juilliard training, like I was like, you know, I had a whole, you know, I'd gotten the script in advance and I memorized it and got ready, you know, because I was like, we're not going to have a lot of time. You know, I like time. I like to sit and stuff. And I was like, you just got to know it, you know. And of course, they changed the script, most of it. And I got it like the day before we started shooting. And I was like, okay. And what I loved about it is, you know how usually you're on set, you're just sitting around in your trailer or wherever and just kind of, you know, me, I'm at Crafty's. That's where you can always find me. I'm always eating. I always gain weight. And with indie filmmaking, I mean, you have no time to do nothing but sit and be immersed in the world and in the, you know what I mean? You take quick breaks, but it's not, you know, you can't get indulgent and like, you know, you can't do 1,001 takes. You just got to just trust your instinct and go. And I actually really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that. Yeah, I shot another film in January on a break during Jitney, the tour. We had like a couple of weeks of a break and I shot this other film in California and it was indie and I don't know how they did it either, shoestring budget, but it was, you know, I got to be the lead of that and I love it. I love it. It feels like camp, you know? It feels like camp, like right. Theater camp or something. Right. I've never been to theater camp, but if I did go, that's what it would feel like.
We talked about some of these things with your morning routine, but when mm-hmm. you are feeling in that kind of dark, hopeless type place, are there any tangible things that you turn to again and again, like a book you reread or music you listen to or something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when I'm in a real dark place, which is rare, but it has happened, it can get real heavy. You know, like if I get dark, you know what I mean? It's like, oof, you know, the person who's always smiling gets sad. It's not pretty. I've discovered that it'll pass, right? Like, so I just know from history, like I remember going through a really dark period at school. I think one of the roles I might have played touched on something I wasn't ready to deal with. And I couldn't stop crying. Mm-hmm. I remember Jim Powell, God bless the dead, was like, nope, you can skip your classes, lay on my couch. And I was literally laying on his couch. Like he was like a father to us all. And he, you know, we can't miss no classes at school. And he let me just cry it out on his couch for days. Like it was ridiculous. Oh my it was gosh. So beautiful. I think about that all the time. But I learned after a number of experiences that, oh, it will actually pass, right? So the thought that it will pass means if you just go through it, not jump over it, because I can go to a sunshiny place kind of easily. And I've had to teach myself to just go through it, because it's always going to be there if you jump over it. If you jump over it, if you suppress it, if you drink it away, you know, party it away, whatever you do, it doesn't go away. It just kind of festers and it's a part of your, you know, and you're wondering why you're snapping on something that, you know, makes no sense, you know, like why you're getting triggered. Mm-hmm. So I've discovered from experience, I'll get through it. So I am more willing now than I've ever been to just kind of go through it. And things I do, I'm not religious, but I will play gospel music. Something about a good gospel song, a good soulful, just a James Cleveland, like just something down and something will just get me to snot nose crying and remembering that it's not, you know, like, there is a power greater than me, you know, like there is it just reminds me that I think everything works together for our highest good, you know, especially if you allow it, Like, I think that's a belief that you can choose to believe. I don't think that, you know, you're not always going to see evidence of it. So some things you just got to just go ahead and say, you know what, I'm going to choose that belief because that feels better. Sometimes I don't see it in the moment, of course, but I remember that. And yeah, I know that I have to work out. Like, that's something. If I'm really, really dark, it's like, okay, you literally have to move your body. I don't know what it is about movement. It just, it, yeah, so I have to. So those, yeah, I think so.
And then the last question I wanted to ask is if you've, if there's any piece of art that you've taken in lately that you want to recommend, like TV show, movie, book, whatever.
So unfortunately, because of the weird traveling I've been doing, like I haven't settled, like I'm just now settling in my apartment here. Like I still have suitcases in the back and it's just, so I haven't been watching much TV lately or much film, but I have to say I've seen a couple of episodes of that Michaela Cole show.
I May Destroy You.
My God. My God, that woman, first of all, I just think she's incredible. And so I've watched a few episodes of that and I was thoroughly taken. So I can't wait to get back to it.
I feel like that's what everyone's been recommending lately. It's made an impact on everyone. We still have like two episodes left. We're almost at the end.
So good.
Nyjah, thank you. This was
This is my joy. You made my month. How about that? I'm happy.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month. Anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please rate or review in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brandon Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.